This is Caitlin Martin conducting an interview with Major General Bob Stewart on November 9th, 2006. So I'm just going to ask by start by asking your date of birth.
Oh my, you're asking how old I am. That's nasty for a young lady. 14 June 1936.
Perfect. So that makes you about what age?
70.
When the FLQ crisis happened.
Oh, well, the FLQ crisis happened.
Okay. And did you know about the FLQ prior to your deployment in Montreal?
Only from the newspapers, where they were blowing up mailboxes and causing some issues in Quebec. A number of them had been arrested. I think there was something like 25 or 30 of them in jail, in fact, at the time of the outbreak of the FLQ crisis.
So had there been mention of military intervention?
No, not in the West where I was serving. I was serving in the Canadian Airborne Regiment in Edmonton, Alberta. So a bit remote from Quebec and the detail of it, no.
Okay, so that was my next question. Where were you were in Alberta when the War Measures Act was declared?
I was the regimental major, really the operation officer of the Canadian Airborne Regiment in Edmonton, Alberta.
Okay. Do you think the element of surprise was important in declaring the War Measures Act?
No, I don't think it was a surprise, actually. It wasn't a surprise to me. It was sort of a natural sort of evolution of the crises, because at that time there was absolutely no intelligence as to the extent or scope of the FLQ structures and their capabilities. There was a total absence of good intelligence that sort of ended up making it, it could have been much worse than it obviously turned out to be. And that was because it wasn't adequate intelligence. So the declaration by the Prime Minister of the War Measures Act was really just an extension of that uncertainty of what was there and the need to have the legal capacity to do what the police needed to do to try to apprehend FLQ members, to prevent further sort of FLQ violent acts. I mean, that's the way I saw it anyway at the time.
So the police needed the military there?
The police needed the War Measures Act. The military can be deployed without the calling of the War Measures Act. They can be called by the a simple act by the Solicitor General of the province can request the deployment of the army and military resources by simply going to the Minister of National Defence and requesting that. It doesn't require the Prime Minister, in fact. The way the Queen's regulations and orders are written, the National Defence Act, it allows the Solicitor General on behalf of the province to ask for the intervention of troops in aid to the civil power. So, War Measures Act was an additional thing. I mean, the troops could be deployed without the declaration of the War Measure Act.
Okay. Perfect. So, how did the public initially respond with troops coming into Montreal?
My sense was from, and I traveled around the city, I was free to travel. I felt that they appreciated this being there. There was a sense of calm that descended once the army deployed. The organization that I was with didn't do it. The sort of guarding of vital points and protection of senior citizens and soldiers on the corners, guarding banks and other installations, provided a sense of security to a lot of Montrealers. So I think they appreciated it. And there was a sense of calm. Actually, I was told, because I operated very closely, right alongside the police, actually, on a day-to-day basis. The incidence of crime took a dramatic drop once the troops were deployed in the city.
Okay. How many troops were sent into Montreal?
I don't know the exact number. The Canadian Airborne Regiment, which I was a part of, was 901 was our actual strength. the brigade from Valcarce deployed. That was 5 brigade, and it would be around 4,000. Whether they deployed all of those, I'm not sure. Troops came in from Gagetown, New Brunswick. A battalion came from there. After we left, and we left early, that's another story. We left before the conclusion of it. Troops from Winnipeg were moved into the city in the sort of tail end.
Okay.
We're talking only about, that's the Montreal operation was called Operation Essay, was its code name. There was a separate operation in Ottawa, and troops from Petawawa were deployed from Petawawa into Ottawa to protect vital points in Ottawa. By the way, one of the fellows who was the brigade major, I believe, of 5 brigade of the brigade in Petawawa lives in town here too. He's another source, General Mitchell.
Okay, great, thank you. So your unit, you're saying about
900. Yeah.
Okay, great. And could you describe your major weapon?
We took small arms. Since we had a specialist unit, an artillery unit, I'm not sure, I can't recall whether they took mortars or not. We were probably ordered not to take them. But we might have taken them. We took machine guns for sure. Probably told not to take those as well. We weren't ill-disciplined. We just, the Airborne Regiment was a very gung-ho sort of organization, very capable at that time. Nothing like the Airborne Regiment later in life, in the life of the regiment. It was, of my 50 years in the infantry, it was, at that time, it was the very best unit I'd ever served with. The NCOs were outstanding, warrant officers and NCOs. Yeah. So we went prepared. If things escalated, we weren't going to have to send home to bring stuff from Edmonton. So I can't remember where their mortars went. The guns certainly didn't go, the artillery pieces, but we may have brought the mortars along, and we certainly had the full range of machine guns and that sort of stuff.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And what did your duties include once you were in Montreal?
Do you want me to describe how we went about that?
Yes.
Well, first off, the first ones to deploy were the Premier Commando Aeroporté, the French-speaking commando of the Airborne Regiment. They deployed on the 15th of October, and they initially went into a variety of places in Quebec. They had their headquarters in Long Point. They had some troops at the Farnham Military Base. They had some at Saint-Sauveur. They had some at Sorel. They had a company at Bouchard, which is near Saint-Therese. And in fact, they're the one that carried out the first raids. They carried out the first helicopter raid. The initial deployment of those people, one commando to all of those places, was to protect vital points. For example, one of the platoons protected at Sorel, protected Bourassa's family.
Okay.
And I know they had machine guns because they dug them in and they established it as a proper defensive position, unlike just setting up sort of a traditional stand-around type sentry duty. They actually dug in. So they did that, and that was their initial deployment on the 18th of October. It was sort of interesting because at that time the Airborne Regiment was fairly new. We were a year and a bit old, and I'd just written an SOP of how to deploy the Canadian Airborne Regiment for winter operations. It was a very complicated SOP, and it had to be complicated because we had to rig bulldozers and road graders and guns and all that sort of very difficult stuff, and it relied a lot on the base Edmonton support, which was an air base, and they didn't understand it. So I wrote a very detailed SOP, and we were going through the processes just at this time, 15th of October, 16th of October, we were going through the processes of practicing that SOP of how we would get ourselves out for an airborne Arctic operation. So all the troops were confined to barracks at the time. We were going through preparations. So on the 18th of October, we got a order to go to 3 hours' notice to move. We were ready to move right away. They couldn't get the airplanes there fast enough to get us out. So we deployed on the 18th of October. We went into Saint-Hubert, which is on the outskirts of Montreal, and an airfield there, obviously. Mobile Command Headquarters was there. We landed there. We moved the troops in, and we resided in two hangars. Our headquarters established itself in an old fire hall on the base of Saint-Hubert. We divided the, so we had then, we had one commando came back to us at that stage. We had two commando. Both of those commandos are roughly 300 strong. We had the Airborne Engineer Squadron and the Airborne Battery. And we organized ourselves to into four groups, the four separate groups. And to do that, we took a company away from one commando and gave it to the engineers, and we took a company away from two commando and gave it to the battery. So that there were four equal groups. We that first night, I wrote the special SOPs so that we could mount two types of operation. One, a vehicle-borne operation to go into the city to do cordon and search operations with the police, and another one to be helicopter mounted, and so it could go to the outskirts and the surrounding country and the cottage country and so forth, because they thought that he might be there. So those were the two operations. One was called the air helicopter one we called Eagle Force, and the vehicle one we called Speed Force. So those. So what we had at any given time, we had the regiment in four. We had one of the one of the organizations on standby to go in the heliborne thing. We had one on standby to go in a vehicle one downtown. We had one in reserve ready to replace anyone who was deployed. And we had a fourth one would be in sort of a 24-hour rest and refit. So we broke down to that. And our job was with the Quebec Provincial Police to go and conduct cordons and searches, where we would fly in with the police. We would put the cordon in so that nothing could escape. And we would lead the operation in fact, and then the police would go in and do an actual search.
And how did people react to the searches?
Well, I'll tell you a story later.
Okay.
I'll tell you two incidents that are sort of interesting.
Okay.
So that's how we were organized, and that was sort of our job. On the 19th, was that happen? No, Laporte's funeral. Laporte was killed on the 18th. That's the minister, the Quebec minister.
Mm-hmm.
And on the 20th was his funeral, and we provided the security, the rooftop security for that particular funeral. And it was the security was very heavy. There was a ground level security that we provided the stuff in all of the rooftops around the cathedral where the funeral took place. We had a mixed bag of sort of helicopters and a mixed bag of vehicles. They were trucks and armored cars and a lot of stuff in that. And the helicopters were a mixed bag of Chinook or of Voyager helicopters and Huey helicopters, because we were Canadian Army was just in fact getting itself equipped with helicopters at that time. So we needed to, we did quite a bit of training. In fact, the one that was on rest, as I've described, would in fact not be laying around in the hangars. They were out doing training. So we trained rappelling from helicopters so we could get in. And this was new, actually. The Canadian Airborne Regiment had just done written the manual of how to rappel from helicopters. So we practiced that because we might have to rappel into different sites. We practiced crowd control. We practiced cordon and search type operations. So there was a training sort of thing that went on at the same time while we were actually waiting to be deployed. It's worth describing how we deployed. We divided the regimental headquarters of the Canadian Airborne Regiment. We split in half, and a half stayed at Saint-Hubert, and the other half went down, and we lived at the Sûreté du Québec, the Quebec Provincial Police building in downtown Montreal, a high-rise building. And we stayed there for a 24-hour shift, and then the other half came down and replaced us, and we went back. So we ran on a shuttle service. So we were right down at the command center, because the Quebec Provincial Police was the focal point of police operations, which caused a bit of anguish because the Montreal police's nose was out of joint by that. In fact, they're a better police force. There they were, a better police force than the Quebec Provincial Police Force. So they didn't like that very much. So the way we operated was the tactical headquarters of the Quebec Provincial Police would get the missions from the Quebec Provincial Police. We'd sit down with them and make a plan. And making a plan with the police is always difficult because they don't operate off of topographical maps. And it's very hard to pin them down precisely where they want to go. They describe it, you know, go down this road for a mile and a half and turn left and go right and that sort of stuff. Whereas we would say we'll be able to figure, have a 8-figure grid reference shows us right where we're going. So it was a struggle with the police to do the planning. We'd do the planning. I'd do the planning with them. And I would call down and have flown down by helicopter from Saint-Hubert the officer who was going to command the operation, lead the troops. He would marry up with the police inspector or officer who was in charge of the police side of the operation. We'd sit down and make sure that everyone understood what was required. And then they would go back to Saint-Hubert and pick up the troops and be off to do their job. So that was sort of our modus operandi.
Okay.
And the way we mounted operations was that way.
And I was told that since it was such short notice that the army was low in supplies, like food, so they were just given money to go and buy food in restaurants.
No, we didn't do that. No,
no, didn't do that.
No, we were fed out at Saint-Hubert. Of course, it's a proper military installation. When we were down at the Quebec Provincial Police, we just went upstairs and ate in the cafeteria.
Okay.
I can't remember whether we paid for it or whether they were providing it.
Okay.
Yep.
Could you describe the morale in your unit?
Oh, fantastic. It was a gung-ho organization, and it was a different, had never done it before. It sounds silly to say, but we had fun. We had fun doing it. It was serious matters, and we did it very professionally, but it was fun.
Okay.
People probably don't want to hear that.
Well, we want to hear the truth. So.
Yeah.
So you've spoken a little bit on this, but I'm interested to know about the relationship between the Army and the Montreal Police Force, or just any police you are interacting
Quebec
with.
Quebec Provincial Police Force.
Yes, yes.
Well, the Quebec Provincial Police Force at the time was a strange body because the officers didn't get overtime and the policemen did. So the officers were a bit beaten up by it, I guess. The Canadian Airborne Regiment operated essentially with the bank holdup detail of the Quebec Provincial Police. Those are the guys that we operated with. And at that time, holdups and Quebec bank jobs were big-time stuff. I mean, it was a big organization. I suppose how we operated with them might be worth me describing how. I went on a reconnaissance with them on a number of occasions with the police. And the way they did it was the officer knew where they were going to go. Unlike the military, where we would get everybody together, brief them, give them orders, and so forth, they didn't do that. The officer dealt with me. We decided that we were going to do a reconnaissance to a specific spot to see if we could do an operation there. He went down to the big open area where the open office concept, where all of the people, the policemen that were in the bank holdup sort of side of life were, and he would go around and just pick people at random and say, go draw your weapons, and they would go draw their weapons, and they'd go downstairs to the underground parking area, And we got into the cars and drove out of the place, not in one car, but in more than one car, two or three cars. We drove directly to where they were going to go, and no one knew where they were going, and there was no stopping en route, except for myself and the person leading. Why did they do that? Because they were afraid of informers, and it was their standard operating procedure in the bank hold-up business that they did that, because they didn't want to have anyone, if you stopped, or if anyone knew where they were going, there was a chance of a leak from within. So,
wow.
So that's how they operated.
All right.
So the police force, what was your question again?
Just what was the, was it a good solid relationship?
It was
between,
okay.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And did the Army defer to the police?
No.
No.
No. If anything, probably it was the other way around, because our planning capabilities and our map coverage and our capacity to know what we were doing and coordinate what we were doing is far superior to the police's capability. How are you doing?
Good. Would you say there was a different reaction from French Canadians versus English Canadians to the War Measures Act?
I couldn't say. I had some contact with local French Canadians. I didn't have any with it. I didn't notice any particular resentment to it at that time. Maybe later, but not then.
Okay. And what about the French Canadians in the Army? You mentioned there was a regiment that was first deployed that was French.
The 1st Battalion, or 1st 1 Commando. No, there was no problem there.
Okay. Did public opinion change over time from the time the War Measures Act was declared to the end of the event?
Well, we left early. The commander, Mobile Command at the time, did not want... we were scheduled to go on an exercise to Alaska with the Americans, and things had sort of calmed down by the later stage. And he didn't want to send a message to the Americans that civil insurrection was rampant in Canada and we'd have to back out of an exercise. So we left sometime near the very end of November, early December.
Okay. So
before the event finished.
Right.
So
but had
up until up until the time I left, I didn't notice any change. Mm-hmm. No.
Okay. And what, in your mind, were the results of the October crisis? How many people were charged or convicted?
Well, they got off pretty easy, actually. They escaped to Cuba for some time. When they came back, they essentially got off pretty light.
And you don't support that ruling?
No. Civil disobedience is one thing, but actual kidnapping people, one case, in LaPorte's case, resulting in his death, whether he was strangled by his own sort of means of trying to escape is another matter. But essentially, I'm opposed to sort of violent acts of the FLQ or of any separatist group.
Okay.
Defend the right to say what they believe in, but I'm opposed to them taking violent actions.
Okay. So one quote that I've read is, "Activities of the RCMP, while disturbing, do not appear to have been known to the federal cabinet in 1970. Do you have any ideas of what these activities...
Burning barns. Have you read that?
Yes, I have.
They got caught burning barns and stuff. Yeah.
Okay, and the military...
We weren't part of that, really.
Do you think that the War Measures Act might have been invoked for other reasons than to deal with this particular issue?
I think the Declaration of the War Measures Act was abused in a number of cases. Certainly, I know in Quebec it was abused. because we were in the Quebec Provincial Police headquarters downtown, a high rise, it's sort of a complex, and we could look out of our windows at windows across the way where there were cells, and there were all kinds of people arrested and put in there just on spec that the police didn't like them, or, you know, they've caused them some problem, or they thought they might be FLQ. So it was abused by a number of police forces, particularly the Quebec Provincial Police.
Okay. And that was different between the police and the Army?
Well, we had nothing to do with the arrests. All arrests were done by the police. We did no arresting of anybody.
Okay. I've read another quote in this book, Rumors of War.
Mm-hmm.
In our search for protection from violence, we must recognize that arbitrary abrogation of individual rights weakens rather than strengthens social order. Do you think the War Measures Act weakens social order to any extent?
At the time, probably not. In retrospect, because people, some people abused it. I mean, perhaps.
Do you have any instances in mind of how it was abused, particularly?
Well, the arrest of people.
Right.
Actually, we could see these people, and they were protesting being arrested. The soldiers found this rather comical, I suppose. They were getting up, standing up in the bars, and sort of so you could see them out the window. And some of the women took their clothes off and thought it was.
Wow.
Soldiers found that more than amusing.
All right, I can imagine. So I have another lengthy quote by Pierre Trudeau, but it is the one which ends where he accuses the weak-kneed, bleeding heart.
Yeah.
And.
I liked it.
You liked it. Okay.
Well, he was right at the time. You know, we can get, we're seeing it in some cases today. You have to show a lot of resolve when you're dealing with violent people, whether they're Canadians or whether they're in Bosnia, Kosovo, Afghanistan, or wherever.
Even if
they
that
do
means
not,
taking
they,
away human rights?
They do not, well, to them, yeah. In some cases, yes.
Okay. So do you think it was right for the government to invoke
absolutely.
The War Measures
Act? At the time, there was no doubt in my mind.
Okay. Has your opinion changed over time? And
well, I'm in favor of sort of... The War Measures Act was really a very... loose sort of act. It allowed too much lenience in the way it was applied. So I'm in favor, actually, of it being more restrictive. In fact, that's what's happened.
Okay. Just kind of a side question. How did this military operation compare to previous military operations? Is there anything special about it? Obviously that it was in peacetime, but anything that kind of stands out in your mind?
Well, we're not used to having to deploy the Army for aid to the civil power operations in Canada. Not very often that it's happened. And it's had some nasty consequences in the past. You've read about the Winnipeg riots and so forth, where there were people killed. And the Army was deployed there, and it's peculiar. It's it's an embarrassing, an embarrassment actually, an international embarrassment when this took place. I mean, it was fun, but it was an international embarrassment.
Okay. So the October crisis brought us to a condition that prevails in many countries whose methods we reject. So what do you think might happen or should happen today if, say, an organization in Quebec or anywhere in Canada, for that matter, took similar actions? Do you think it would be invoked again?
Well, the War Measures Act wouldn't, because it's, I don't think it's no longer on the books. The deployment of the Army, absolutely. As sort of uncomfortable it is to think that there will be some organizations, whether they're separatist or for other political reasons, takes on violence, and the police are incapable of controlling it, and aid to the civil power is invoked, I see no other recourse. In fact, it's embarrassing internationally if it takes place here, but tough luck. That's just the way it is.
Do you think that perceptions of this event have changed as our notion of terrorism has changed? And how we view terrorism today in 2006 versus
mm-hmm.
this was an isolated terrorist incident in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think?
Well, the terrorist incidents of today will be harder to define. I mean, we defined the FLQ crisis by the fact of an organization calling itself FLQ. It was isolated essentially in one province. The terrorism that's likely to take place in Canada in the future is going to be harder to, it'll be like Quicksilver. It'll be hard to put your hand on where it's taking place, where the organizations are that are conducting it. And, it'll be much harder to control.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that is pretty much my questions. Are there anything you'd like to add?
Well, I
want to
tell you. I want to tell you two stories.
Okay, great. I'd love to hear a story.
What else did we do? Well, the first one was the lack of intelligence of the RCMP and the Quebec Provincial Police, and everyone was quite astounding. And in the Quebec Provincial Police building, they had the organization was the think tank of the operation, trying to figure out where the hell they had Cross and where they had held Laporte. There were a number of communiques from the FLQ to them, and each time one of these communiques would come, there would be a flurry of activity in the think tank, which was run by the Quebec Provincial Police with Montreal Police, RCMP, D&D in it. It was sort of one floor down from where we were located. So I visited there on a number of occasions to listen to what was being discussed. They were desperate for intelligence. They, in fact, brought in a soothsayer, fortune tellers, trying to find out, quite astounding, how desperate they were for any sort of intelligence. The one story I'm going to tell you was passed, I didn't hear it personally, it was passed to me by a very reputable source, a full colonel who was permanently down in the think tank. And this comes from a Cross actually wrote letters to his wife that his wife got. Those letters have never been made public. So it's hard for me to go back and substantiate it. But they got this one letter from Cross to his wife. And in it, it appeared that he'd got the wrong date, somehow the wrong date. And they were looking in the letter for coded message. These letters to his wife. And the wrong date. And they said, well, he was a great fan of Homer and the Odyssey. And so this wrong date is a chapter in the Odyssey. They went to the Odyssey, and in that chapter, Ulysses, the Latin name for him, but Ulysses is being held captive on an island, and he learns that his best friend has been killed, or his friend has been killed. He said, aha, he's on an island. And then it appears that he's misspelled terrible. And they said, well, a Brit would never make a spelling error, so he's trying to tell us something here. Well, if you look on a map of Montreal, the city of Montreal, and there's the main river goes through, let's go on that way, and then there's a north river that goes around, because Montreal is an island, and on the north of the island. There's a town by the name of Terrebonne. I said Terrebonne. And in the middle of the river there, there's a little island called Île Saint-Jean. And I said, he's being held at Île Saint-Jean.
Wow.
So how's that for a stretch? Officer came to me and said, I'd like to go out and do a recce of Île Saint-Jean. So in the cars we went, and I went out and looked at Île Saint-Jean. Well, when I saw it, I said, there's small chances being held there. There were actually some buildings on it. There was some sort of high-rise condominiums. And, shit, he's not there. He said, oh, okay. Well, I said, maybe he's not there. Anyway. They let it drop. They didn't do it. But they did it later, actually. They actually went out there and went into those buildings and did the cordon search in that thing. And I wasn't there at the cordon, but I'm told that, you know, people were absolutely astounded. People knocking on their door at 4:30 in the morning,
looking for Jesus.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's one of how desperate they were for intelligence. The other one was a thing, one of the last ones we did, which was called Operation Sailboat. And Longueuil, which is on across the river, Longueuil is sort of here, Saint-Hubert is here, Montreal being there and the river here. They said he's being held in Longueuil, and he's being held in Albert's Pet Shop. Mm. So we did a thing called Operation Sailboat, where we took the whole regiment, 900 guys, at about 4:30 in the morning, roared out of Saint-Hubert, roared down and put a cordon in around Albert's pet shop, and the police were there, the bank hold-up guys, and they all got out of their car. I was sitting right beside them, and they went over to Albert's pet shop, and I knew he wasn't in Albert's pet shop. There was just no doubt in my mind. It was a modern little building with a plate glass fronts and stuff. He's not in there. And they went over, and they tried the door. It's 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning. The door wasn't open. You could see the cogs going around in their head, and they went back to the car, which was parked over in the parking lot of a shopping center. They got out a sledgehammer and went back and smashed the front door, plate glass door, and went in. And they were only in about 3 seconds. And, of course, there was no cross in there. They came back out, and they looked around. And there was a little old Chinese restaurant next door in the Quebec style with apartments above it, just a sort of like an old house type thing, with outside staircase leading up to the doors leading into the apartments. And so, again, they stood around, and you could see the cogs going around in their head, and they said, well, we're here, we might as well knock off this place next door. And they charged up the stairs, banged on the doors, and I watched as a little old lady came to the door in sort of a kimono or whatever, and absolutely frightened silly, dumb policeman banging on the door. My two stories of two of the operations, they were desperate for any sort of
encounter. A bit embarrassing for the
police. embarrassing for everybody.
Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Up sailboat.
Okay, well, that's great. I'd like to thank Major General Stewart for participating in this interview.
Yeah.
Great.
How's that?